Olive Shapley, who has died aged 88, was a pioneering radio producer, one of the first to midwife the voices of ordinary people onto the airwaves. In a career spanning 40 years, which reads like an ordnance survey of British broadcasting, she also worked as a prominent presenter in radio and television. Her private experiences of two nervous breakdowns of psychoanalysis as a socialist professional woman and a single parent anticipated current concerns by 50 years. Paddy Scannell, the historian of early radio, has argued that Shapley was one of the first British programmers not to seek to impose their own vision on their subject, but to allow the subject to define themselves. To help her, she seized on the mobile recording van, a 7-ton vehicle whose creative possibilities Shapley immediately recognised and which she used to develop her own broadcasting style. Born in Peckham into a lower middle class Unitarian family, she was named after Olive Schreiner, author of Story of an African Farm. Like so many of her contemporaries, she was radicalised at Oxford, where she read history at St. Hugh's. Her fleeting membership of the Communist Party was to dog her for the rest of her institutional life. Shapley got a job as Children's Hour organiser in Manchester. In 1934, it was a crucible of creative radical programming initiated by Archie Harding, a Marxist intellectual whom Reith had banished from London to where he couldn't do so much damage. At a time when the regions mattered much more in the BBC than they do today, the North region, under Harding, had its own distinct culture. Members included Wilfred Pickles, Joan Littlewood, the singer Ewan McCall, documentary producer Geoffrey Bridson, and Shapley. In 1939, Shapley was promoted to assistant producer, and so began a stream of remarkable documentaries which, for the first time in British broadcasting, made imaginative use of recorded actuality. Her first, presented by Wilfred Pickles, was on shopping. It was followed by features on canal workers, long-distance lorry drivers, homeless people, miners' wives, and 24 hours in the life of a big hotel from the staff's point of view. So much for the innovation of the recent TV docu-soap Hotel. Apart from the introductions and links, they were unscripted and unrehearsed, with ordinary people speaking about their lives to an extent previously unheard on British radio. Her most famous feature, the 1939 The Classic Soil, was one of the most radical programmes the BBC had ever broadcast. Scripted by Joan Littlewood and produced by Shapley, it opened with a plummy BBC voice and ending a programme inspired by the book The Condition of the Working Class in 1844 by Friedrich Engels, and proceeded to put into question a century's social progress. Even now, it stands in striking contrast to BBC notions of balance. At the end of an evening of GPO film unit documentaries at the Academy Cinema in London, Alberto Cavalcanti played Shapley's Homeless People and invited her to collaborate with them on a film and radio project, Health of the Nation. She did so and worked alongside Humphrey Jennings for a time during the war. In the meantime, Shapley had met John Salt, the BBC's North Region programme director. In June 1939, the Daily Mail and Daily Dispatch leaked his engagement to the girl whose voice is known to millions of radio listeners. There was considerable opposition then to married women working, and BBC policy was not to employ staff married to each other. After their marriage in July 1939, Shapley resigned and worked for the BBC on a contract basis, producing documentaries about ordinary people's experience of the war. In 1941, Salt was posted to New York as Deputy North American Director of the BBC. America energised them. They lived for a time in the stylish Fifth Avenue apartment of Alistair Cook and employed Mabel, Cook's part-time Harlem maid. Through their friendship, Shapley gained access to the black community, enabling her to send back programmes about black people in America. She also sent a vivid fortnightly newsletter to Children's Hour, which included memorable interviews with Eleanor Roosevelt and Paul Robeson. They were the precursors of Cook's version for adults, initiated 4 years later. In 1949, Shapley became the presenter, sometimes called Comair, of the Daily Woman's Hour. She brought formerly taboo subjects like menopause and women without men onto the air. When domestic crises occurred, she brought her children in to work with her. They learned to sit quietly and draw on the back of old scripts and became experts cutters of tape. By now, the family was living in Hampstead, and Shapley was writing articles for Modern Woman magazine. In 1950, she began working in television, presenting the Women of Today series and narrating tales for very young children in Olive Shapley Tells a Story. In 1952, she married Manchester businessman Christopher Gorton, and the following year they moved back to Manchester into Rose Hill, an enormous Victorian Gothic house in Didsbury. By the late 1950s, Shapley decided to shift to TV production rather than presentation and devised an innovative books program, Something to Read. She had to fight the BBC to get Guardian journalist Brian Redhead as the presenter. They objected to his supposedly incomprehensible Geordie accent. Okay, now this document is considerably longer than a document you would get in the exam. It would be shorter than that, which is not necessarily a good, makes it easier, because sometimes the longer ones are easier. Now, I'm not going to go through a proper text commentary, but I'm going to look at some of the things which would be good to put in there. So we always start with who's writing, who are they writing for, and what is their objective. And sometimes it's complicated. Here it's not quite so complicated. They're writing in The Guardian, a daily centre-left newspaper in Britain, very much read by students and teachers. Now, I'm sure there are some bus drivers who read The Guardian, but when you think of The Guardian, you think of students and teachers reading it. This is important. This is something you should know. That's considered to be general knowledge. Four or five daily British newspapers and what style they are, that's something you should know. It's written by Anne Karpf. Well, we don't know anything about her except she's a journalist, so I'm not going to say anything about that. And it's an obituary. When do you write an obituary? When do you write an obituary?
When someone dies.
When someone dies. In fact, when someone has just died. If somebody is living, don't write an obituary about them. They will be upset. Yeah? And people do this. Of course, journalists have obituaries ready. Of course. Famous people are going to die. You know. Now, every newspaper in Europe has an obituary of Jean-Marie Le Pen already prepared. Because he's old. Yeah. I didn't. Let's put the news on just in case it's our lucky day. Okay. But if they died a long time ago, you can't write an obituary about them. It's too late. Yeah. So it's so the writing the obituary now. Well, a slightly more difficult question is, what is the purpose? This person, Olive Shapley, she was a radio producer. A lot of radio producers die, and they don't get a page in The Guardian. There is something exceptional about her. What's exceptional about her?
She was one of the first to midwife the voices of Virginia
Woolf. That's one thing, is that she introduced documentaries of a new sort. That's true. Remember, you would need to use your own words. Yeah. But there's something else exceptional about her. It's not exactly mentioned, but it's kind of obvious. In the 1930s, when she became a radio producer...
She's a woman and she's a podcaster.
Exactly, yeah. You can imagine in the 1930s, there were, 53 men producers and two women, yeah, or maximum, yeah. This is really the reason why she has an article, yeah, because, if she was just an average radio producer, well, they're not going to put a full page in a daily newspaper. En plus, les coupés, hein, c'est les plus longs. So, what is important about her is that she was a pioneer woman in the early BBC, and the women have often been forgotten. And one of the recent jobs of historians is to find the women. Of course, there was only a small number of women, but nevertheless, that it makes them important. So, that's the objective. What do they say in this article? Well, they go through some of her. In fact, it's interesting. It's quite interesting that they don't mention. They don't say a lot about she was the first woman. Well, we know that that's important, but they don't actually say a lot about that. Yeah, that's not sort of taken for granted. And in the article, then, to summarise in our own words, the author goes through some of the originality of Shapley, some of her difficulties. When she married, she had to resign. She got married, she had to resign. And many of her achievements, a whole series of examples of articles on working class people in the north of England, on black people in America. You can imagine in the 50s, you know, how many white journalists were interested in black people in America. So, yes, yeah, so she's been presented as a rather radical person. Okay, now the four objectives of the text commentary are to show you write good English, to show you understand the article, to show you know the history of the BBC. The exam is an exam of the history of the BBC. So if you only show information which is in the article, that's not good. So what you need to show are what are the big currents of BBC history which are illustrated in the article. One of them is the history of women in the BBC, which is illustrated in the article in a couple of ways. First of all, she is one of a small number of women. I know what I will do now. I will give two more examples. Then the examiner will know that I know a lot about the history of the BBC. For example, you would be perfectly entitled to write a sentence about another exception, Hilda Matheson, who was John Reith's number two. She was the director of talks. That's a surprising example. Yes?
What about the woman who seemed
to... Exactly, yeah. you will know before the exam. Nan Winton. Yes, that you could say that the story of Olive Shapley illustrates part of the history of women in the BBC. The BBC was very much male-dominated for many, many years. I think it may be beginning to end. When you put on the BBC today, sometimes you find that you have, you know, a committee, a panel, to discuss a question, and you have the three people, and it's three women. So your things really are changing. The exceptions were people like Hilda Matheson, the first director of talks, or people like Nan Winton, the first national woman newsreader, although she remained for several years, I think 8 years, the only national woman's reader. Yeah, there's one, and then 8 years later there were two. It was very, very slow change. In paragraph number three, you can see an illustration of something about the early BBC. At the end, you can see, first of all, you can see that in the Manchester team, there were some very left-wing people. In paragraph three and four. Well, in paragraph four, they mention Ewan McCall, communist folk singer. Joan Littlewood, you don't know who she is, but she's another communist. And in paragraph three, they mention Archie Harding, who was a Marxist intellectual. So they had a team full of very left-wing people. And this poses a problem for the historian, because we all know that John Reith was very conservative. He thought Hitler was okay. Yeah? And so how can we explain that he has this important team full of communists? You don't know, but I'm going to tell you. And that is that, you see, John Reith, it's true, he had very conservative ideas, but what he also believed in mass education, and he wanted good radio. And it's not easy. Some people are very good. C'est comme avec les orateurs politiques. Vous savez bien qu'il y a beaucoup de politiciens qui parlent. C'est assez ennuyeux. Mais il y en a quelques-uns qui vraiment savent parler. Je ne vais pas les nommer. So what seems to have happened is that John Reith was working with Archie Harding in London. And then he said, I want you to move to Manchester. That is to say, Archie Harding is a Marxist. And John Reith, who was the Conservative boss, didn't say, we don't want you. He said, oh, we'll move to Manchester. And I'm imagining, but I can imagine him saying, oh, Archie Harding, he's a Marxist, that's pretty stupid. But he makes good radio. And that's very, very important. And so he's keeping he doesn't mind. John Meath doesn't really mind that this is some. I mean, of course, he would mind if his committee was full of communists, the managerial committee. But you know, the workers, you know, well, as long as if they're good, it's okay. So this shows really something of how the early BBC had a wide variety of people involved, and they were even prepared to employ some women. Yeah, if they were good, and it seemed that Olive Shepherd was good. In the previous, in paragraph two, the most important thing about Shapley that is mentioned is this idea that she was the first not to seek to impose their own vision on the subject, but to allow the subject to define themselves. You can imagine this. So she's done a documentary there in the 1930s about long-distance lorry drivers. And so she's interviewed long-distance lorry drivers. And according to this article, she has not written the programme before the interview. You can do that. You can say, oh, well, these are the 4 points I want to make, and we'll find an interview to illustrate them. Yeah, that's television producers often do that. It's a pity, but they often do that. They already know. I remember I went to the BBC to be interviewed about Music Hall in the First World War. I'm an expert on Music Hall in the First World War. And the BBC producer, before they began the programme, said, I want you to say that at the beginning of the war, all the songs were patriotic songs, and then at the end of the war, they were not so patriotic. So he told me what to say before the programme. But it was completely false. It was completely, I know, he doesn't know, but he had decided what he wanted me to say. And this is very typical in radio and television. So I said something completely different, and he never invited me again. Yeah? No, it's true that they're very often, they want their programme to fit into the, the prejudices, really. And that's what he's saying. He says she was better because she went to see the lorry driver and say, what are the difficulties of being a long-distance lorry driver? What is fun about it? Yeah? And she found the subject expressed himself. So this is radical in a general sense, in that it's the idea that everybody's voice deserves to be heard. Yeah. So that's what she's saying about. So here, you could give another couple of examples of how radical producers were successful in putting radical content onto the BBC, which nevertheless is generally conservative. It's not conservative every day, but it's generally conservative. So, for example, Ewan McColl and the Radio Ballads, very new social documentaries of a completely new style. Or you could talk about the Wednesday plays. That is to say that because they talk here about allowing the subject to define themselves, this gives you a good reason to write three sentences about Ewan McColl's Radio Ballads. You must not write 15 sentences. That's going off the subject. Because the two big mistakes, I know you know this, the two big mistakes for a text commentary are, one, paraphrasing the original, saying the same thing in other words and nothing else. You might get eight. Yeah? Okay? And the second big mistake is what we call la récitation de cour. So you find something and then you say, Monsieur Mellon, qu'est-ce qu'il a dit? Et vous racontez tout ce que j'ai dit. Non, je ne me moque pas, parce que je sais que le commentaire du texte n'est pas facile, et donc on se rassure un peu en répétant ce que le prof a dit. Okay. So the idea is to avoid both only saying things in the document and giving too much detail. So the perfect example here is that because she says social documentaries, you can write three sentences about your McColl, but not more. You're just showing you know it. You don't need to explain it. The examiner, which is me, knows. So there you go. Now we have over the page when they mention that she is that she has to resign when she's married. If you remember, it would be good to say yes. After 1932, women in the BBC were obliged to resign when they got married. And this was part of a change in the BBC that, rather surprisingly, before 1932, what was surprising was not the banning, it was before, that for the first 10 years, the BBC was pretty modern, pretty progressive. They said, yeah, equal pay for men and women. Yeah. Let's have our number two, the director of talks, as a woman. Wow. If women get married, they can continue working. But in 1932, the BBC decided, because it was becoming more established, to follow the big banks, to follow the education service, and say, no, we don't want married women in here. But also, you see that when she resigns, they managed to find an imperfect solution. The BBC, she continues to work for the BBC, but as a freelance, as an independent, it says here, she worked for the BBC on contract, on a contract basis. Now, this is still oppression, yeah? She deserved a salary like the others, but they are finding a way, because she's good, they don't really want to lose her. At the very end of this document, you have a sentence which refers to another current of the history of the BBC. At the very last sentence, in the late 50s, when Shapley produced a new programme called Something to Read, the BBC didn't want Brian Redhead to present it because he had a Geordie accent. Does anybody know what town you live in if you have a Geordie accent? It's a Newcastle accent. A Geordie accent is a Newcastle accent. A Liverpool accent is a Scouse accent. A London accent is a Cockney accent. These are nicknames. And so here the problem was they had a quite intellectual programme. A program about books. And Shapley said the perfect person is this guy. He has a neutral. He has a Newcastle accent. You don't mind, do you, BBC management? And they'll be, oh, no, we don't like that. And this is an illustration that for many, many years, the BBC liked to have only people with a BBC accent, speaking Queen's English, basically a bourgeois accent. And very slowly, it was possible for more voices to be heard. Indeed, before the Second World War, there was a committee to watch the radio and make sure that the accents were not unacceptable. Yeah. So this was a form of elitism. So this last sentence, where it says the BBC didn't want a Newcastle accent, is one example of elitism in the history of the BBC. And this gives you a reason to write 5 sentences about elitism in the BBC. It doesn't matter which example. There are 100 examples. But if you give 2, that's good. Yeah. And again, it allows you to write 5 sentences about elitism in the BBC, not 15. Because then you're going off. Je plus rien à dire du texte, donc je pars sur autre chose. Okay, now I just have 1 or 2 more things here. Yeah, interesting. Interesting that she sent these programs back on black people in Harlem. Oh yes, just 1 more. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Paragraph 5. Now, as I say, you will have a shorter document. Paragraph 5 is interesting because if you look at the last bit, so this is when she is doing programs on homeless people or lorry drivers, etc. And it says, apart from the introductions and the links, they were unscripted and unrehearsed, with ordinary people speaking about their lives to an extent previously unheard on British radio. Now, this is something perhaps you've forgotten, but at the beginning of the BBC, everything was scripted. So if you invited a writer, we're going to talk about your new book, send me the text of what you're going to say. Oh yes, that's very good. Now I will read my questions and you will read your text. At the beginning of radio, it is ridiculous, but this is because, of course, at the beginning of radio, nobody knew how to do radio, because it was new. Everything was scripted. So it didn't sound very natural. And gradually, and this is an example of how people needed to change the way they did things for radio. I remember saying to you that scientists who give talks for the general public, before the radio, they gave them in a theatre of 3,000 people, no microphone. I would like to explain to you. And they had to learn how to use a microphone, which is completely different. So this is an example of how the radio invented broadcasting, and in this case, invented that you could do things without a script. Now, scripting or not scripting is important in broadcasting. Also in the cinema, I don't know if you know, but there are some directors like Ken Loach who don't use a script. Well, they use very little script. They just give a few ideas and because they want it to sound natural. Well, thank you for listening to so carefully. If that's enough for today, I'm going to get some lunch.